Hi, Big Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 871. Daniel Hopsicker, Raj. Again, this is being recorded on October 30th of the year 2015. And I use the title to the program, Daniel Hopsicker, Raj. Again, because you were out of the journalistic saddle, so to speak, due to a brush with mortality. And speaking for myself, and I'm sure the listening audience as well, we are not only very grateful to have you back and right in the journalistic saddle, but we are indebted to you for your heroic efforts over the years.
Hey, Dave.
Yep.
I've been behind the lines here in the South too long now, okay?
Uh-huh.
When you said brush with mortality.
Yep.
What they say down here is, I like to die.
Well, as long as you weren't doing the fixin' to die rag. And, yeah, it is. I know on your website you ruminated a little bit about what that experience is like, and having just, well, not just, but having very recently overcome a life-challenging illness myself, it is something to which I can relate, as they say. Any thoughts you would like to share with the listening audience before we go into some of the material that you have been covering since you got back into the saddle, so to speak?
Well, I was inordinately pleased and gratified to discover that while I lay there waiting for an operation in the hospital for 4 or 5 days, I was okay with however it went. I mean, it was serious, probably not like completely life-threatening, but I realized that I'd lived the life I wanted to lead, you know, and that it was, I wasn't going, wait a minute, I forgot to do this, I gotta go, you know. I was, 63 at the time, and that's a pretty full life. So I was okay, and that's that's a neat thing to know.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're going to run with the pack, then you are going to go over the cliff with the lemmings when that time. Even though superficially, at any rate, our society glorifies those who make lots of money and appear on Dancing with the Stars and similar things. In the end, I think integrity is what it is all about, and doing something that is meaningful and that adds to our civilization is really what it's all about. There, actually, the ancient Greeks had a definition of happiness that I think is to be considered in this context. They, you know, we think of happiness as, oh, make a lot of money, you know, find the right spouse, get a nice house, get a nice car, be famous, you know, have a lot of likes on Facebook, so to speak. The ancient Greeks defined happiness as the exercise of vital powers along lines of excellence in a life affording them scope. And I think that applies to you. You've been exercising vital powers along lines of excellence, God knows, and it is a life you know, that has afforded you scope, including a limited degree of exposure here on our airwaves.
It's been interesting. You know, 15 years ago when I got into Barry Seal, I had never met a spook in my life. And, you know, had certainly never been the subject of disinformation. So it's fun in that way. I mean, you know. So what do you want to talk about, dude?
Well, why don't, you know, we just had another Republican debate, so to speak. And I will say that so far the Republican primaries have been surprising to me, because I figured that Jeb Bush was more or less a shoo-in.
You want to know the big news so far?
What's that?
The big news so far is the number of authors out there who have been planning major books on Jeb Bush, who right now standing around, you know, wondering why they bothered.
Well, it could be. You know, certainly there is a lot to cover. And so far he is picking a back seat to Donald Trump's hairdo and Ben Carson's je ne sais quoi and a lot of other fresh fertilizer, shall we say. You have already written, not necessarily a book about Jeb Bush, but you definitely have written about him in Welcome to Terrorland, Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida. And recently, during a talk radio appearance, Jeb Bush's behavior vis-a-vis Huffman Aviation and 9/11 and the remarkable constellation of airlines and airfields that appear to be completely above not only the tarmac but the law itself came into focus. I wonder if you would, in no particular order, update us or refresh our memory about what Jeb did in relation to the files of Huffman Aviation and what happened when this came up on that talk show.
Well, that's the point. I mean, what Jeb Bush did on the day after 9/11 is one thing, but had these two kids in New Hampshire, the Jackman brothers, not brought it up, you know, to him in a news conference, we wouldn't have had his response. So kudos to them. I met them. They had me up to speak at a school in New Hampshire a few years back, and now they're out in the big world, and they're funny people. Jackman Radio. I don't have the URL, but just type it in, you can find it. So they asked him about is it true that he had been aboard the C-130 that had flown out of Sarasota, and if so, can you tell us what happened to the files? And Jeb Bush acted like, how weird are you, you know? And he began raising his voice to take another question, but then he got indignant and said, I was in the emergency operations center trying to make sure the state of Florida was safe, trying to work with local officials to figure out how to make sure another attack wouldn't hit and devastate our economy. That's what I did. So that was kind of a weird question. Well, it wasn't, and he lied. He wasn't in the emergency operations center.
Jeb Bush lied? Jeb Bush?
But he, you know, it's a catchable lie.
Yeah, you bet.
And now I have to go back to genesis of the story, because I know your audience is extraordinarily, you know, well-read, but still. When I first got to Venice, Florida, I got pulled over by cops twice the first day I was here, which was the tension was palpable, and so I went to see the chief to check in and say hi, and didn't get to see him, but saw his media person, who told me what set me on my quest. I asked him. I said, "Look, all I want to know is, does Rudy Deckers have any local priors, meaning prior arrests? Because Rudy Deckers had been the face of the 9/11 story." Explaining who Mohammed Atta was, and he looked like a crook to me. And this cop looked pained. His face kind of contorted. And he said, I'd love to be able to tell you about Rudy Decker's priors. He said, but I can't. He said, this morning, or note, the day after 9/11, he said, two Ryder trucks sat right out there, and he pointed out in the parking lot. And on them they loaded all of the files, all of our files. And so he couldn't tell me if he wanted to because he didn't have any files.
Interesting. What was loaded then, perhaps, onto that?
All of Venice police files. They weren't copied. They were physically impounded.
Right, so in other words, the files on Huffman Aviation were the Venice Police Force's files on this mysterious airline, and
they'd already loaded all the files from Huffman Aviation, and then they went to the police station, and but when they started the morning down, I just found out just very recently, they started the morning down in Charlotte County, the Charlotte County Airport, where Mohammed Atta had been. And they completely, the sheriff of Charlotte County, 2 days after 9/11 came out and said, hey, Otto was here. He's been sending regular emails to a guy here at the airport that sold him some gear. And, they've been living in Deep Creek, which is an area of Charlotte County. And then we never heard another word from him about it. Okay. So they started the day, the FBI did. At the Charlotte County Airport, grabbing everything that said Otto had been there, came to Venice, stopped at Huffman, grabbed all of that stuff. Then they stopped at the Venice Police Station, got all of that stuff. And then these two Ryder trucks drove right onto, according to the spokesman of the Venice City Police Department, Ryder trucks were driven directly onto a C-130 airplane on the tarmac at Sarasota Airport, which flew to Washington, D.C. with Jeb Bush on board. Direct quote, with Jeb Bush on board. Much, much later, I talked to a man. I don't want to identify him specifically. He was on the flight crew on that plane, okay?
Right.
And, yes, Jeb Bush was there, he confirmed. And he also told me something that I didn't know, which was that the files never made it to the FBI.
Aha. Uh-huh. And they went where?
Langley. They landed in Langley.
Oh.
They didn't land in D.C. They landed in Langley.
Well,
yeah, that's a new wrinkle, isn't it?
Of course, and for younger listeners, that is the headquarters of the CIA, which is named for Jeb Bush's father, number 41, George Herbert Walker Bush. And so I guess in this instance, at least, the truth did not necessarily set us free, which is the CIA's motto and is right on the floor of the lobby of CIA headquarters.
One of the things I've become aware of in this kind of like weird line of work is how many times the FBI is forced to kind of front for the CIA, and it must get old to those guys, but they have no choice.
It does, and not only FBI, but DEA, elements of it anyway, are just fed up
with
the CIA drug trafficking.
Tell me about the DEA, dude. I got major news about that.
All right, let's hold that thought and fill in, because it has been a while since we have been over Welcome to Terrorland. Remind me, Daniel, I don't think I'll forget, but at the end of the broadcast, let's inform listeners where they can get your books and how and where your website is. One of the really strong features about your work is the way that your first book, Barry and the Boys, and your second book, Welcome to Terrorland, Muhammad Atta and the 9/11 cover-up in Florida, and subsequent stories on your website, not only dovetail but represent an unfolding of a deep political narrative that goes all the way back to the mid-1950s, winds up through the assassination of President Kennedy, more about that in a minute, the Iran-Contra affair, government-sanctioned drug smuggling during that, and then when you don't take care of one piece of business, other business comes in. Then we find one of those intelligence-linked, actually more than one intelligence-linked drug smuggling airline is the vehicle through which Muhammad Atta and company come into the U.S. But by way of refreshing people's minds, I wonder if you could briefly sum up Jeb Bush, Huffman Aviation, Discover Air, or maybe Discovery Air. I'm operating off the top of my head. And everybody's favorite political female, Catherine Harris, and that tale, so that the presence of Jeb Bush, rather, on this C-130 with the files of Huffman Aviation and the Venice Police Department's files on Huffman Aviation, landing at Langley, never apparently making it to the FBI, and then Jeb's subsequent equivocation about this. If you would maybe place that in some historical depth for us.
Well, Catherine Harris. If you want to know why the terrorist trained in Venice, look at Catherine Harris, because that's You know, what we learned in MENA in the 80s, watching what was going on there, or as much as we were allowed to, was that you need a certain dominance, you know, among local media, among local political officials and law enforcement, and they have had that. They, meaning the covert forces of our country, have had that here in Southwest Florida for 50, 60 years. The important thing to know, okay, the one thing that's important to know about 9/11 is that 3 weeks after Muhammad Atta arrived to attend flight school at Huffman Aviation, the owner of the flight school, Wally Hilliard, had his Learjet impounded on a runway of Orlando Executive Airport by DEA agents wielding submachine guns who found 43 pounds of heroin on board. 43 pounds of heroin is what I came to understand is known as heavyweight in the heroin trade. Apparently, I was given to understand that nobody stumbles on 43 pounds of heroin by mistake.
So in other words, you're not going to get that by compiling frequent flyer miles.
Right. And so this is the guy that owned the flight school, that Muhammad Atta and Marwan, the two guys that took down the World Trade Center, where they learned to fly. And I couldn't break that story to save my damn life. Was there anything more salient than what I just told you to the story of 9/11?
Well, obviously not, although I think that the larger context that you have also developed is equally important and again, brings into focus the deep politics that lies around this event. Can you briefly, I know from what I gather from reading Welcome to Terrorland, Catherine Harris was about the only person to ever fly on Discover Air.
The local officials supported the effort that was there and underway in a number of different ways. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, there are half dozen. It doesn't help to be too specific. Wally Hilliard got money from the government in a half dozen different ways. And he retired to Florida and immediately bought, or within the next year, bought 30 to 40 jets. And I live in Florida now, and I know when guys retire to Florida, they kind of like they get a little more colorful in their golf pants, and they start playing golf a little more. But rarely do they retire to Florida and buy 30 to 40 jets.
No, that certainly is unconventional retirement activity.
Wouldn't you think a big newspaper like the New York Times would print a story like that?
Well, you know,
let me tell you why they wouldn't.
Go ahead.
Because their affiliate in Sarasota was owned by a publishing family that must be unique in the annals of newspaper publishing. They published the Sarasota Herald Tribune, a newspaper, and they were weapons merchants.
Oh.
And the weapons they were selling, the Lindley family, they weren't like anti-tank cartridges something that is a weapon of war. They were refitting P-51s from World War II, our fighter plane.
Right. That, by the way, is the Mustang. Plane. Go ahead.
And they're refitting them, bringing them up to, you know, today's code. And the reason they're doing that is because the P-51s were a propeller plane, and the Air Force has nothing now but jets, and propeller planes are able to fly much slower than jets. And so by fitting the latest machine guns, twin machine guns, on these propeller planes, they were able to mow down peasants much more efficiently. Because where this Lindley family sold that weapon, that plane to, was like the most repressive regimes in the world. Honduras, Guatemala, I only know a few of the names. I mean, you know, I could look them up again, but one time I did. But, you know, places where they were used in civil wars that killed several hundred thousands of peoples. And this was in the 70s and 80s. And this guy is the publisher of the Sarasota Herald Tribune. So if you want to know why you never heard about Muhammad Atta in Venice, Florida, you know, and his little quirks, there you have it. It was the damn, you know, they owned this part of the world.
It certainly sounds like their operation and the deployment of the aircraft that they had retrofitted or refitted was involved with covert operations in the Third World and Latin America.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And that really...
And the other thing about the other thing about this publishing family is that the father and son, who together ran the thing for 40 years, were both stationed in World War II. They were on the staff of General Chiang Kai-shek in Kunming, China.
Really?
Which is, and you may know something about this, Dave. That's reputed to be where the nationalists were shipping heroin out of to America to fund their war against the communists. God bless them. God, a lot of wars are funded with drugs. Let's face facts here. That's what the nationalists were doing. But the interesting thing about that is that these two guys from the Seattle World Herald Tribune are right there, and who's also right there is Claire Chennault. And guess where Claire Chennault of the Flying Tigers, General Claire Chennault, reputed to have been America's first drug trafficking, commissioned officer. And where else General Claire Chennault was the same time he was in Kunming, China, was in Southwest Florida.
Right, and General Chennault was the commander of the American Volunteer Group. Those were the famed Flying Tigers, sort of a foreign legion air wing that actually predated American formal military involvement in World War II, and he then became a prime operative not only of covert operations, but his wife, Anna Chennault, became a major fixture of the China lobby as well.
And the first major drug seizure on a plane in the area here.
Right,
was 1934.
Really, which really predates World War II, obviously.
It does.
Yes,
but there you have it.
You know, it was interesting. Just a brief digression. The OSS officer, that was America's World War II strategic, their intelligence service and the direct predecessor of the CIA, a guy who was assigned to Chennault for a period of time, was an OSS officer named John Birch, who was recruiting Chinese puppet troops who had fought for the Japanese, and he wanted he was recruiting them to fight for Chiang Kai-shek and the U.S. against Mao Zedong and the communists. Roughly a week after VJ Day, that's where he got shot for doing that, and his name, of course, was given to the John Birch Society. That's where that comes from.
Wasn't the Nelson Bunker Hunt and the Hunt family big backers of the Birch Society?
They most definitely were. And one item I don't want to linger on too long, but Nelson Bunker Hunt also formed something called the American Volunteer Group, which was the same name that General Chennault used, and it was reputed to be committing political assassinations using a cyanide gas gun developed by the Third Reich. And volunteer carries a very deep meaning when used in connection with people like Chennault, Nelson Bunker Hunt, his father, H.L. Hunt, and others.
Would it surprise you to learn that the two DC-9s that were involved in the drug smuggling operation through St. Petersburg that I've been following for half a dozen years, that both those DC-9s were owned on several different occasions by Nelson Bunker Hunt's granddaughter?
Really? No, I did not know that. Now, is this the, I really couldn't call it a plane, but is this the complex around what you have termed Cocaine One?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. Let's put that one on the back burner for just a minute, because we have, and again, I think this is one of the really strong parts of your work, is the way it begins with Barry and the Boys and then winds up through history, moves on up through 9/11, and yet we still have planes up along the Barry Seal, now involved with the milieu, my favorite word, surrounding Muhammad Atta, Wally Hilliard et al. And then in your articles on the Mad Cow Morning News, what I call the herd shot around the world. You have updated many of these goings-on and continued to track the evolution of these elements right up to the present time. Daniel, I'd like to maybe, before we get into some of the many stories that you have investigated since we last had you, since you last graced our airwaves, there was a recent conference in New Orleans about Lee Harvey Oswald and his activities in the summer of 1963. And, of course, in Barry and the Boys, you track drug smuggler and CIA officer par excellence Barry Seal and track his career going all the way back to the Civil Air Patrol in the 1950s, and he was part of a Civil Air Patrol unit commanded by David Ferry and including Lee Harvey Oswald. I wonder if you would, and there is a recent story that is linked to the description for this show that will be published after the program has been recorded, but you have traced some of those elements going back to the 50s and then tracked Barry Seal and people like David Ferry and others right on up through the events of 11-22-63. I wonder if you would reflect on Oswald, the summer of 63, Barry Seal, and some of the real flying tigers with a small F and a small T that were operating in and around New Orleans and that figure in the events of 11-22-63.
Oh, my. Dave, the most important thing I can tell you is that I discovered that Barry Seal had gone to the same Louisiana Civil Air Patrol summer camp in 1950, summer 55, that David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald attended and met at. So he was there with them. He would have known Lee Harvey Oswald. He would have known David Ferry. I mean, it's a small world. And, you know, and that's an important point. Probably one of the most useful things anyone has ever said to me was when a retired U.S. Customs agent in Louisiana noted my surprise at learning one of these guys knew another of these guys half a world away, and he looked at me and he said, it's not surprising at all. He says, it's not, what did he say? It's a small world out there. There's not that many people out there. That's what he said. There's not. They all know each other. Barry Seal met David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald, and then he became a CIA pilot, and his career is probably, you know, exemplary for that. I mean, he flew weapons to Fidel Castro when the CIA supported him, which was a surprise to me, and then he flew weapons to anti-Castro elements afterwards, and he had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. And that surprised the heck out of me, or he was alleged to have had something to do with it by an impeccable source, a former member of Richard Nixon's National Security Council.
That is interesting. I know in Barry and the Boys, you discussed what was an apparently a hypothetical role of Barry Seal in flying a small aircraft that may have been a getaway plane for some of the assassination teams. And I've forgotten the guy's name offhand, but you quoted one veteran covert operative familiar with the drug traffic. Might have been Chip Tatum, I'm not sure, offhand. But when you spoke about a getaway plane to take some of the Kennedy assassins out of Dallas, and the guy commented, would have had to have been a 747.
To get them all out.
Yeah, there were so many people involved. That it was embarrassing.
It was embarrassing, exactly right. You know who that was? Because I can say his name now, because I'm 95%, I'm convinced he, well, last time I spoke with him, he was dying. Gary Eitel, EITEL, who had an outstanding career after being a CIA pilot in Vietnam, as a CIA lawyer, putting right a couple of major things the CIA had been doing wrong. Gary Eitel was an American hero, Dave, because he wasn't afraid to tell the truth. Or he wasn't afraid to tell you about what he saw, you know? I mean, which anybody should be able to do.
EITEL, as his name was spelled.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. He exposed back in 1988 that the U.S. Forest Service had been getting from the CIA C-130 planes supposedly to use in fighting forest fires out west, and had been turning around and selling them to Mexican drug cartels. And that one of them actually had been confiscated on a runway at Mexico City Airport. This is an incredible figure, but they said it had $1 billion worth of cocaine on board.
So many of the operations that you have been tracking, of course, Wally Hilliard got busted with 43 pounds of heroin.
Yeah, I mean, it's a line through it all, okay? I mean, what if Prohibition had never ended, who would run America, okay? The people who make and sell booze.
And basically, drugs
are booze squared.
They are indeed, actually, per unit volume, a heck of a lot more profitable. And so many of the tributaries that you have been investigating involve massive cocaine trafficking,
drug trafficking.
With the complicity of elements of our own intelligence community.
Let me just say this, okay? Anytime you see a drug story about Mexico or Colombia, you know, anywhere in South America, Caribbean, you know, anywhere in the world except here, it's bull. Okay, it's disinformation. They're pointing a finger outwards, so you never look and say, what's going on here, okay?
Yep.
And big news, I now know what that operation out of St. Petersburg was part of. And you know who I have to thank for that?
Who?
We can spend a minute talking about this. Vince Vaughn.
Now, he is an actor, is he not?
Yes.
Okay.
Vince Vaughn, he's an actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing publicity because he starred in this year's True Detectives on HBO. I mean, which everyone watched last year. It was great. This year sucked. But in an interview with GQ magazine in England, he made some it doesn't matter whether you're for or against gun control. What he said was unseemly. He said people everybody in school should have guns, and any mother or father who has lost, you know, one of the several hundreds of kids who have died in gun violence in schools maybe in the last 10 years, that was insensitive, and it ticks me off. And I realized that I had some 6-7 year old information about a connection between his mom, a woman by the name of Sharon Vaughn, who was a well-respected financial advisor in Chicago, and who ran a $35 million hedge fund, that his mom had something to do with standing up funding the bogus investment bank that owned the DC-9 busted with 5.5 tons of cocaine.
And that was, that is the plane that you have nicknamed in your article.
Cocaine One.
Go ahead.
Guess where Vince Vaughn's mom lives?
Fill us in.
Chicago, Illinois.
All righty. Home to a lot of enterprise, shall we say.
So the next time you see El Chapo Guzman's face in a newspaper,
mm-hmm,
or on TV, think Whitey Bulger.
Really? Now, Whitey Bulger, of course, was the criminal, master Boston criminal, who was also a longtime FBI informant. Robert Mueller, up until recently the head of the FBI, was actually in charge of the FBI's operations in Boston for much of that time. Whitey Bulger was a federal informant and had actually been advised by members of a Ukrainian fascist group called the the OUNB and UPA. He also, I was reading recently, he was one of many people whom the CIA had experimented on with LSD in the 1950s, something I did not know. But yes, Whitey Bulger, an interesting guy.
He took it for like 60 days in a row in Atlanta Federal Prison. I've read like every book about it by now. And
wow.
And what you failed to tell your audience was that the movie about him, who did it start? Johnny Depp?
Yeah.
It was a terrific performance. I forget who it was, but a major,
That was a star. I haven't seen the movie, but yes, definitely.
At any rate, you know, Whitey Bulger fronted for whoever in the government wanted him to front. I mean, you know, I'm sure it wasn't just the FBI. Okay, he controlled. I mean, you look at El Chapo Guzman, and you're looking at a guy who has been collaborating with the CIA for more than a half dozen years now.
Okay. He's the fellow who just escaped in Mexico, correct?
For the second time.
Right.
But apparently, he's a pretty slippery fellow.
Iron bars do not a prison
That's
make
right.
when you're here like him, okay?
He has skills.
Yep. And grease, more than a little bit, apparently.
Uh-huh. So, thanks to Vince Vaughn, you know, I have I can tie this together for what it's worth. I can show you. I can give you a list of, or at least this one line, of American drug lords. And they're pretty much the usual suspects, but of course a lot of them are people you've never heard of.
Okay.
So, but it all ties together.
It
all ties together through Chicago. Both of the DC-9s came from Chicago. I know the story of them now. This all ties into a much larger network that seems to have centered around a company called IPA.
All right, and do you know offhand what that stands for?
I've got it here. International something Associates.
Okay.
Profit Associates.
Yep.
It's in a recent story.
Sure.
So there.
the tendrils that stretch out from cocaine one are fascinating.
It depends on how far back you want to go. I mean, you know, this ties into things that this ties into a network that included Burt Lance. Remember him?
Yes, indeed. He was a top advisor to Jimmy Carter, and then when the BCCI purchased a bank in Georgia, and he facilitated that. That was the first White House scandal against Jimmy Carter, or the first negative checkpoint against Jimmy Carter way back when.
And a couple of bankers, famous bankers from Tennessee, I think they're both passed away now. So I gotta finish the book that I've been working on with mixed success for the past few years because it's all now clear and it goes back, you know, when they caught the son of one of the top guys in the Sinaloa cartel 3 years ago and they extradited him to Chicago. His attorney filed papers saying my client couldn't have committed any crimes because he has immunity given in by the CIA because we've been collaborating, you know, down here in Mexico to, like, control this cartel situation.
Of course, control could be interpreted perhaps in that context as regulate and not neutralize.
No, of course, exactly. Think Whitey Bulger.
Yep.
I mean, you know, Whitey Bulger, they made a lot of money. What you can see there is if you want to be a real crime boss, the place to do it is from like the FBI, or the CIA internationally.
Certainly, powerful elements of it. You have published a number of stories, many of them, the complex or the constellation surrounding Cocaine One. And again, a lot of people involved with that. As I recall, the original plane, was that the one that skidded off the airway, or am I confusing that with a plane in New Jersey? It skidded off the airway, and then it turned out that they had 5.5 tons of cocaine on board, which, you know, somehow didn't make the flight manifest.
You know what? There's been so many. You're forgiven for... The first plane that was brought to my attention was the DC-9 that you're thinking of, Cocaine One.
Okay.
From St. Petersburg, that went down to Colombia and got busted in Mexico on its way back. And I know why it got busted, too, because it happened right at the time when control of Cozumel and the Yucatan Peninsula was shifting from the Sinaloa cartel to the Zetas. And so this plane had been used to, like, you know, flying in and landing and refueling and then, you know, taking off for the States. And they were, you know, incredibly surprised to discover this was not going to be the case this time.
So, in other words, basically one faction was edging out another one.
Exactly. And it also had to do with the transfer of power between the president of Mexico to from the really bad from Fox to you know, the guy that took his job, a faceless entity whose name escapes me at the moment, but he the one that preceded the current Niente, whoever he is.
Alrighty, yeah, I can't remember his name offhand either, but you know, a couple of things. Just one of the things you mentioned briefly about guns and. School shootings, which certainly has been very much in the news lately. One of the striking things, though, is if one considers the loss of life coming from the use and abuse of drugs like, you know, heroin or cocaine, they have destroyed an awful lot more lives than firearms brought to bear by school kids. And yet we find that elements of not only the governmental power structure, but also of the financial industry and also the world of celebrity crop up in connection with this. And some of them, at least, are complicit up to a point. Which is, you know, people are worried about somebody bringing a gun to school and blowing away a bunch of classmates, and yet, you know, 5.5 tons of cocaine can destroy an awful lot of human life.
You know what? I don't. Respectfully, I must disagree. Alcohol kills what, 500,000 people every year. You know, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 in car accidents directly. Tobacco kills, you know, probably even more. How many cocaine deaths are there a year? You know, I would be surprised if we were out of three figures.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't tell you the exact number.
I bet more people die of bee stings than of cocaine overdoses. That could be wrong.
I think, though, if you compared the number of kids who were, what I was doing was comparing the number of kids who were shot to death in school by a classmate with the number of cocaine deaths. Certainly the number who actually physically die from taking too much cocaine may be quite small, but it can be part of a lifestyle that will thoroughly erode people's health. And it is true that, you know, the most destructive drugs in the society are the legal ones, alcohol and tobacco.
That's where, you know, you want to talk about where drugs hurt people. It's in the fact that there's 2 million people in prison today for dealing small amounts of what the CIA is bringing in by the ton. Okay?
Right.
Now, having said that, I mean, and I've spoken to someone who I thought was with the CIA about this one time, and I said, I don't mind that you guys are bringing drugs in. I said, I'd rather have you do it than some whacked out South American dictator controlling the trade because of the amount of power that's going to give them. I said, but if you're going to do that, you have an obligation to the 2 million people that are in prison for selling small amounts of what you're bringing in by the ton. 2 million people are in jail, and a lot of them have made wrong life choices, but we all have. And more importantly, each one of those 2 million people, most of them guys, have moms, right? Have mothers.
Sure.
Okay? And I know how my mom would feel if I went to prison. So imagine, like, the human misery that this hypocrisy called the war on drugs commits every day. Every day. It's unthinkable. It's unimaginable. And I think the rest of the world is, like, repulsed by it.
And although it will never emerge into American mainstream journalism past a point, I think the example of Gary Webb and what happened with him, when right here in the Silicon Valley he ran 3 days, maybe 4 days in a row, of front page stories about the CIA complicity with the Contra-connected drug traffic, and he was then professionally destroyed and lambasted by, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, and altogether unfairly. So I think that
speaking of that, they try to keep us away from accurate information that they don't want us to hear. And that and Gary Webb, by the way, is what got me into my current line of work. I was outraged by what I saw at a distance, okay? Because in 1996, it was all news to me. But I could easily see that he had been right, and that he had been punished for being right. So instead of winning a Pulitzer Prize, he was run out of journalism. But speaking of that, Dave, you yourself and the people you work with and for there are almost an unparalleled resource, as far as I'm concerned. Probably, you know, and I don't do much talk radio because I don't like to hear myself talk. But your questioning and your audience is obviously far more sophisticated than virtually anyone else I've spoken with, and you know a lot of stuff. So I think everybody out there knowing that there aren't any commercials and that it's a view. Not viewer, listener supported, you know, should pick up the phone and call whatever number you're going to give them at the end of the show and make a small, you know, supporting continuing donation.
We'll get into that in a formal sense in just a couple of minutes. But yes, this program is carried on non-commercial stations that are dependent.
They're going to kick you off everywhere now, right?
Well, I hope not.
That was just heartfelt, dude. That had nothing to do with like a professional. You know,
there's an old Turkish proverb, Daniel. He who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. And I've been chased out of a few. I'm hoping to hang in there a little bit, though.
They say the same thing here, my friend, but it's a little shorter. They say you can't fight City Hall.
Yeah, really. A question. The fellow who was sort of the official voice of the Venice Police Department, trafficking back for the initial, or going back, I should say, to the, our initial topic of discussion, was that the late Mike Trainor?
Yeah, Mike Trainor.
Who then died of cancer at the ripe old age of 47.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Pretty sad. I mean, when I read the obituaries about him, I was sad I didn't know him. You know. Beyond one or two conversations.
One wonders, and I'm not making this as a statement.
But he was like that. I don't want to interject, but from reading his obituary, he was the way he was with me was the way he was the whole time he was there. He would speak as the spokesman at the Venice. He would like regularly speak the truth and let the consequences fall where they may.
But they all
loved him there. I mean, yeah. apparently, just you know.
I don't know anything about his lifestyle, and I'm not making a statement, but rather simply raising this as an interrogatory element. But the Freedom of Information Act documents have revealed that for years the intelligence community and the CIA have had means of killing people by inducing cancer. So it's simply a thought for people should entertain, given what he apparently knew about what was going on at Huffman Aviation and with people like Rudy Deckers and Arnie Krutoff and the rest. You know, Daniel, we were talking about how this sub rosa world of drug trafficking takes place with the complicity of some powerful elements, and occasionally we hear some famous names in conjunction with this. And one story that you penned, although from what I gather from your reportage, the celebrity was not implicated, or at least there's nothing directly implicating her, but you mentioned that there was a major cocaine flight that was busted on Paris Hilton's property. I think it was in either Costa Rica or Honduras.
Yeah, that happened. That reportage makes what I do sound probably more serious than it is, Dave. But I like that. I thought you were going to talk about Jeb Bush and George W. Bush allegedly loading drugs on a plane, which Barry Seal may have had something to do with. At least that's the rumor, and it's a persistent rumor. And when you hear it 20 years after Barry Seal's dead, you know, you go, well, maybe something's there. Who knows? Who knows?
Certainly, Jeb Bush was part and parcel to the Florida intelligence-related milieu that was up to its eyeballs in drug trafficking. And as I recall, there was a plane that was in, this is an old story of yours, a plane that was in, I think, Barry Siegel's Air Armada, so to speak, that had at one point been used by George W. Bush to fly around when he was governor of Texas, as I recall.
Yeah, in 1986, Barry Siegel's favorite plane was a twin-engine beach that had been a mil-spec plane. When they make propeller planes, they're mil-spec, they're like to meet Pentagon regular, you know, so they're much better than regular,
right?
Regular planes.
Mil-spec
is went from being yeah. Barry Seal's plane, in 86. He didn't need it anymore after they killed him. To 4 short years later, 1990, being the favorite plane, according to I think Houston Post, of Texas Governor George W. Bush.
And it is ironic who basically went AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard during the Vietnam War years and then became Commander-in-Chief, which is quite remarkable. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to wrap up here and carry on some station business. Dan, you also have a piece, and maybe it's unfair to bring it up at this point in the broadcast with only a couple of minutes left, but a piece about several very courageous women in Mexico who have been calling fresh fertilizer, shall we say, on the official story of the Mexican drug cartels and what's going on down there.
My favorite story, Dave. K.S. Masmacho. U.S. or Mexico, free press. And they're women. I mean, in journalists, 30, 40 a year are killed down there. And these three women have all had, like, you know, not just death threats, threats of slow, gruesome deaths.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just to be saluted. Each and every one of them. Their names are Carmen. Carmen Aristegui, Lydia Camacho, and Annabel Hernandez. And Lydia Camacho's story was particularly interesting because it involved some of the same people that were involved in the DC-9 down there. She's writing about the same people. And in fact, what I learned from her was that this group involved with the 5.5 tons down there is called the Narco Pederastas because the two top dogs in the syndicate are both Lebanese, and they both apparently have well-documented tastes for small children of both sex. The Narco Pederastas.
Uh-huh.
How about that, my friend, you know?
Well, I guess the family that plays together stays together. Maybe we won't carry that one on any further, lest we run afoul of the FCC. Daniel, in just a couple minutes, I'm going to... In fact, let's wrap things up now. I have been talking about the threads of continuity and the cast of characters that you have been investigating running from the 50s through Barry and the Boys, through the JFK assassination, and then on up through the intelligence-linked drug airlines through which Muhammad Atta and company infiltrated in Florida, and then right on up through your myriad of stories in the Mad Cow Morning News that I call the Herd Shot Round the World. Tell us where people can find your stories and get your books.
Mad Cow Prod, PROD.com is my website, Mad Cow Morning News. Hopsucker, H-O-P-S, you know, is my name. That's where my stuff is. That's where the stories are. 250 of them.
And there will be links in the description for this program, which will be published later this evening and available on the SpitfireList.com website. This concludes, for the record, program number 8. 71. Daniel Hopsicker, Rods. Again, it has been my pleasure and privilege once again to welcome Daniel Hopsicker back to our airwaves. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This is being recorded on October 30th of the year 2015.